This is session number 58, recorded on March 10th, 2008, and this is side A. So we're looking at the tiny note chart, and I would say notice in the middle column under 2TU, you have sections called monad, triad, dyad, tetrad, pentad. And remember, the chart is the view from the hexad position. But you could take the first four levels, the LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker quadrants, and look at them as a tetrad. Something's enhanced, something's retrieved, something's obsolescent, something's flipped into. So the four-part structure of the first four levels can be considered a tetrad, yet the tetrad manager can do it from the monad position, the dyad position, the triad position, or the tetrad position. So that in the 19th century, we have in the Holyopathic Radio Satellite Quadrant, which we abbreviate to the LaRouche Quadrant, 1840-1900, probably what people think of as the Hegelian dialectic, thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. And a lot of people are into the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberger or Council of Foreign Relations conspiracy. They think those guys are doing the Hegelian dialectic. But that would be a 19th century means of management. That's the way it was done in the 19th century, because it was a more industrialized, centralized, hierarchical, visual society. So one position, one central fulcrum, would have the attitude of modulating the different factions, the different political conflicts and struggles, and the different institutional struggles. It would be done from, we could call, a monadic position, all right? So that LaRouche retrieves that sensibility by emphasizing the Leibniz's monad in his philosophy and theory, and he's miming the monadic position of 19th century clever management of society by the HCE gang. You know what I mean? The secret intelligence elites, right?
Right, and from Bob's formula chart up to 1900, we're locking down one half world government.
Right. And a novelist, Joseph Conrad, he wrote,
actually 1840 to 1900, we're locking down the electrical government.
Right. And the Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, Orwell's vision of 1984, the management of three parts of the world, those would be 19th century x-rays of the pattern of management by the elite. And it would be monadic, so that Joseph Conrad would write novels about double agents. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the scenario of pop culture detective and spy stories on TV, you know, since the 50s and 60s, would bring in the idea of double agents, and that would be manageable, maybe even triple agents, that would be manageable from the monadic position.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the triad position.
Well, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the triad position, which is in the Holyopathic Television Satellite phase, the McLuhan Quadrant, the triad knows it's more than managers fighting with different ideologies. Technology's starting to take over and creating an inevitability and involving mass emotion through technologies like radio, all right? This mass emotion, this new living electric effect, would require a bit more sophisticated tetrad management, and it would be more sophisticated than the monadic view, not as sophisticated as the tetradic view, but would be triadic. And McLuhan was pretty good at analyzing society and exposing the triadic level of the managers, or approach of the managers, all right? It's like the monadic is when money is in the period when money is owned by private capitalists. All right? It hasn't reached the period where money is owned by the public. That comes in the 30s with the welfare states, and that's when McLuhan says the managers take over society from the owners. The owners give it up in 1929. At least they're marginalized. And the real power, day-to-day power, goes from the monadic bankers to the managers. And they have to deal with trade unions and more of a participatory democracy image than the monadic guys did. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the managing of different groups looking for consensus, was a term used later, is the triadic. So McLuhan satirized that. You could say that LaRouche satirized the monadic view. He would expose the futility of it. But it was also interesting how how LaRouche would posit himself as the antidote to Kissinger. Kissinger representing the monadic oligarchs. The oligarchs kind of get sidelined in the 30s and 40s, so the mass crowd becomes a factor in power and public images. So McLuhan satirizes that kind of tetrad management. It's, if you think of tetrad management as a kind of jujitsu by the elites to create a red herring, say the problem is over there, not us, we're not evil, the evil is over there. So simple scapegoating is a 19th century monadic form of clever management. And then it gets a little more complicated when you have the radio effect. So that's partly why I have McLuhan in the triad section. Then when you get to the dyad, that is the simple structure of peaceful coexistence. It's actually the crowd fighting within itself. It's like the communist versus the capitalist, or the right versus the left. That kind of simple quarktoon. And quarktoon means, we've been talking about that. If you actually look into details, and then the way the public media and politics reduces it to simple battles between the left and right, that kind of simplification is the cartooning of media imagery. And the quarktoon is showing how there's so many cartoons that are offered, so many different temporary conflicts, them versus us, presented in the media, in the news, since the 50s, that's what I mean by subatomic quarktoon. It's the simplification of the cartoon image.
Yeah, Bush is good at that. Sometimes the Democrats want to say, well, you know, it's a complicated situation. There are all these different factors, and we need an intellectual like Bill Clinton to think these things through. And then you have, like, Bush says, it's not complicated at all. There's good and there's bad. There's black and there's white. This is what we're dealing with. We've got an evil. We got to go get them.
Right. Now, I would look at Bush as a later stage man using all four. But we'll get to that, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you could say the Reagan era was dyadic, the demonization of the axis of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Or what did he call it?
The evil empire.
The evil empire, right. So the dyadic is a later phase where the managers aren't in control anymore. McLuhan says after the managers, the phase of control after the managers is advertising. And advertising is based on the Nielsen ratings, and that's studying groups and figuring out which group will identify with this, which images. And so the battle of the group's images, or what I call the mythic stages in my memo to Prince Charles, that is the dyadic situation. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
So just to pause for a moment, because questions arising that I'd like to get taken care of regarding advertising. While listening to a lecture that Eric McLuhan gave and put up on the internet, he talked about something that Marshall said about advertising, where the advertisers know that you don't want to, that you feel bugged by the ad, and that after a while you're not going to pay attention to it anymore. And then they have you when you're not paying attention to the ad. And then he used the example of a burglar wants to get into a house where there's a couple of guard dogs, and he has a piece of red meat, and he tosses that in. The dogs focus all their attention on the red meat. In the meantime, the burglar goes about his business in the background, and the dogs are unaware that, you know, he's just, you know, taken a bunch of things and left. And so he was using those metaphors for advertising, and I didn't really understand what Marshall meant by that, and I wanted some clarification.
Well, Marshall used to say that ads weren't meant to be noticed. They go to work on you if you're not really paying attention to them. And one way to get people to ignore ads is to make them irritating and corny.
Yeah, and play them over and over until you just don't want to. You don't want to see it anymore. You turn it off. You go, oh, I've seen that five times, and you turn it off, or you turn your attention away to something else.
Yeah. Now he's claiming that there's some kind of operation going on, but he did say, when he was featured in Newsweek magazine around 1966, 67, he said Madison Avenue couldn't condition a mouse. So even though the ad were attempting to work on you like the burglar with the piece of meat, he said they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know that they were putting hot ads on a cool medium and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he then talked about the later when they caught up to that and started putting cool ads on cool media, resonating with the television effect. He said that was the soft sell. Well, that was the term that people use, the soft sell. He also said that advertising creates the disease and offers the cure. So maybe one of the subliminals is that it works on you, bothers you, you ignore it after a while, and then you fail to notice that it is creating a dissatisfaction or a felt need for something,
mm-hmm.
creating a disease in you, a lack of completion. You need to supplement your being with this new product.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, well, you feel a need to scratch the itch, and you've been made unaware that the ad made you itch, and then you're unaware that the ad gave you the solution to the itch.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all, so we're juxtaposed the idea that Madison Avenue couldn't condition a mouse. Advertising is like the juicy piece of meat, a distracted watchdog of the mind, or it creates a disease and offers the cure. It's also a general, as in the Soviet Union used to give statistics on their news programs of how much corn was harvested that day or how many new tractors were made. It would list industrial output. The advertising in the West was serve that form of function by presenting a society in harmony. He said, McLuhan said that advertising was a handicraft version of media ecology. We know media ecology was turn up the radio, turn off the TV, then you get too much TV, put the newspapers out, modulate these massive landscapes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So advertising is offering a image of coherency of all the different functions that goes on in an industrial, post-industrial society. It's like a news report about, well, look, we've done this and we're going to do that. And then all the ads of all the different projects and products brought together form a media ecology. So that's another interesting fact there, that the coherency of people's sense of what is all this work we're doing, where does it lead to, it was summarized iconically by advertising.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a state of statement of where we were at. So there's that function. So I don't know if we could say exactly where the conditioning came in the old stimulus response level
mm-hmm.
that McLuhan
didn't emphasize.
Yeah. But it seemed like Marshall made a lot of advertising during a certain phase of his work and his writing. And I don't see that you have advertising included in, well, you have the Hex advertisement, but I think that seems to be the only emphasis you have on advertising in your chart here.
Yeah, the chart is serving the function of an ad. It shows an ecology of relationships between the different quadrants. There's that use. Let's see. He says by the late 60s, advertising becomes an art form. It's like not even ground anymore. It's figure by the end of the global theater in the late 60s. It's becoming tougher for advertising to be what it was when he spelled it out 20 years before in The Mechanical Bride, you know?
Well, advertising sort of then becomes branding. I mean, there are certain things that people need. I mean, everybody's going to buy toilet paper of one brand or another. Everybody's going to buy gasoline. So then the thing is, but who are you going to get it from? So then it becomes a question of how they brand the product, which attracts people to want to, you know, they're going to, you know, there's certain things people just are going to buy, period. But who are they going to buy it from? And that's where branding advertising comes in.
Well, he called it the war of images or the war of icons. It was that was the importance of the ad, was to give charisma to your product or interest. So how does it do that if it doesn't want you to notice it? But anyways, to give you charisma in a product, like a politician, the elections turn to the battle of images, not platforms or issues. It was the targeting of a politician's charisma to a certain demographic or to everybody, whatever the dice was thrown towards. Advertising was a larger expression of what went on in presidential elections every 4 years. It was done in advertising every week. The idea of, you call it branding now, but back then it was the war of Pepsi versus Coca-Cola, which had the most charismatic advertising to attract people and feel identified with the images
right.
Implied. Right?
Yeah, and then Marshall said, you know, one day the advertising would become more satisfying than the product itself. And I've actually found that to be true in many cases.
Yeah, advertising became the lesson. It told you how to feel about a product you bought. And then you have that phrase, I don't know when he did this one. Might have been in the later 60s, early 70s. Advertising advertises advertising. So that as advertising became lost in the global theater, it became a function of serving itself. Advertising advertises advertising.
Yeah, we got to get the advertising dollars. That's what it's all about. Who cares what the product is? As long as we get advertising, as long as we get advertising dollars.
Right, but that's the way it originally was. Now, if advertising...
I mean, advertising becomes a commodity in and of itself, regardless of what it's selling.
That might be advertising advertises advertising might be his explanation of how advertising becomes an art form. It's a meta level. It's talking about when if people start to see values of nostalgia or values of the past in advertising. Just
yeah.
Like they appreciated movies better as an art form in the 50s and 60s after TV usurped the movie as ground. So advertising no longer ground in the 60s and 70s, so people start to study or start to notice advertising as an art form. And so the better...
But you especially notice it around the time of the... the big year-end football game. What do they call that? The
Super Bowl.
Yeah, there's two things to look forward to at the end of the year: the Super Bowl and then the advertising that goes on between, because that's where they put the best, they put the most money and the most creativity into, you know. And so that, you know, the day after, everybody talks about who won the Super Bowl and what were the best ads.
Right. So it's like an Olympics. It's the festival Mardi Gras for the advertising industry. They strut their stuff. It's an Olympics in their terms for them, for their institution.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, they are expressing the abundance that advertising originally enhanced, the image of abundance. So now it becomes status to be aligned with a global participation medium called the Super Bowl. Like Christmas, Super Bowl is like Christmas, something that people share in for a sense of national or group unity.
Right.
And so it's a, so the advertising battles over or gets prestige by being a host of that event. And they're it's like asking if the who the host was and how well they did at the Academy Awards. You know, every couple of years they put a new host in and they compare that host with someone else. Well, in the Super Bowl, the ads are the hosts, and people compare the host or the, its parts.
Right.
Are compared to the previous years. So, anyways, how do we get on to... So we're talking about the dyad, and then we got... Oh, you brought up the side issue of the of advertising and what Eric said about it.
Yeah.
Well, advertising, McLuhan used to say, was the repository of the real folk art. Therefore, it's anonymous art of the 20th century, and it's what will be studied by archaeologists and anthropologists and all that. In 200, 300.
Yeah. Well, its function is to sell you something, and so Madison Avenue hired, you know, a couple of hundred, maybe I'm exaggerating, but, you know, a couple of hundred psychiatrists, put them on their staff to try to figure out how to get into everyone's head, you know, dissect the public psyche and figure out how to get into its head so that we could insert advertisings and advertisements that would sell stuff.
Well, that was the old method in the 40s and 50s. By the 70s and 80s, they're looking at niche marketing, and they're not necessarily trying to get into the heads. They're getting into the tribal group. It's like New Guinea had 500 tribes, and they didn't speak to each other. Advertising picks a little tribe, and they modulate the sociological profile of it, and that's what they appeal to. They don't get, so they brought in the anthropologist, as you get in later.
Mm-hmm.
You go past the individual psyche. That was back in the 30s and 40s when they were individuals.
Yeah.
Well, the last mind took over.
Talk about the tribal fragmentation of culture in that talk that I referenced that Eric I heard listened to on the internet. He says that, now this sounds like an exaggeration to me, but he says there's evidence to suggest that the generation gap is down to 3 years now. In other words, a 15-year-old can't figure out what's going on with his 11-year-old sibling, because the 11-year-old sibling is picking up on, is getting into new technologies, being shaped by the new technology that's coming in, and is already mutating into a different headspace.
Right. Well, the user-generated, user content-generated media, especially coming in with YouTube, MySpace, that's a different kind of, radically different kind of media than the previous media that the Generation X and the baby.
It's something we haven't even talked about that I've been just investigating over the last couple of weeks. It's been going on for a year or two now, but this is one of these multi-user virtual worlds. The one I'm looking at is called Second Life. 65,000 people at any given moment are participating in Second Life, and they've built out millions of acres of property in there, and the sophistication of the economy, the social network, it's you know, as one person said, if you can find it in, you know, real life, you can find it in Second Life. I mean, I don't know if you call it a stock market, but they actually have to regulate the virtual money that is used in Second Life in order to buy and sell products. And they have to regulate the currency, and it's amazing. But that space is, I think it's the next thing that needs to be examined beyond YouTube, because YouTube, you get to be a mini broadcaster, but in Second Life you get to be, Second Life is like turning on a, you know, you would turn on a cartoon and watch it. But now you can actually take one, you can you can possess one of the characters in the cartoon and begin to animate it, begin to use it, and have it represent yourself in that world.
Well, that's kind of editing. That's another aspect of user-controlled media. That person creates the avatar for itself.
Yeah. And then, like, the lengths that these people go to adorn their avatars with, they have fashion shows at Second Life. Some people sculpt their avatars in order to become models so that they can strut the runway with, wearing fashion designer clothes by real live fashion designers that are designing fashions for these avatars, and there's sporting events and all kinds of things going on in there. And because it's a cartoon image, and these images can actually be sculpted to some degree to actually look, you could actually have an artist actually take, you know, your photograph and sculpt an avatar that kind of looks like you. And because it's kind of a cartoon space, well, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, and Marshall pointed out that the outline is such a cool medium that you can really project your imagination into it. There's really a sense of kind of like being in there with other people and you know, hanging out and partying or whatever. It's just in the very beginning stages, but it's a profound new medium that's going to really be. I'd read that probably by 2011, probably 1 in 4 computer users will have a Second Life, at least one Second Life avatar, because like Mercedes-Benz is building cars in there, so that you can buy a freaking car and drive it around. And I noticed today H&R Block just opened up a thing in there where you can go in and get free tax advice. And a number of university colleges have a Second Life campuses in there. I watched a program with Eric McLuhan was in an avatar form that was made for him, was being interviewed by this guy Kenny Hubble in an auditorium that was sort of representative of, I think, of like an auditorium in Fordham University. So it's it's a whole big deal going on in there. It's really something.
Well, let's say then the real action is tactile. It's the participation and intimacy and interplay that people are addicted to, and the avatar, that visualization of themselves, is the figure. And it may not really be about the avatars. It may be another example of tactile surfing, that the feeling of the place rather than what it looks like is the attraction.
But it's amazing how people actually project themselves into the characters. I was listening to this podcast of these women who talk about, you know, the best places to buy things in Second Life and how to spend your money the best way so that you don't feel that you got ripped off and that you get the best, you know, like they're, you know, particularly into buying clothing or buying artwork for their condominiums or what have you. And, but they talked about how, like, trying on a new skin, you know, sometimes, you know, you want to try it on. You want to like go into the like little private cubicle that they give you to try on clothing because you feel too naked to just do it in the middle of the store and it seems inappropriate, you know. And
but people could see you doing it in the middle of the store.
Well, they could if you did it in the middle of the store, but you know, protocol is you go into the little dressing room where you can be sort of hidden for a little bit and while you try on a new skin or a new piece of clothing or something, you know. And there are places in Second Life where, you know, people get really vulgar and sexually explicit too, but it depends on what community you're in and what the sort of some of these areas are. Sort of they sort of have a rule. The rules are enforced by almost by committee or by consensus. I mean, there are certain areas you just don't, you know, where you it requires that you have a little more etiquette and a little more respect for, you know, the other people and stuff. And it's really wild.
Okay, so it sounds to me like it's a and I saw the Eric McLuhan Kenny Hubble dialogue. I saw that last fall. So it sounds like that the chemical body is getting so marginalized that it can only occupy the chip landscape, and you're seeing this nostalgia for chemical body activities, like going on a fashion runway or going shopping. All these things that one doesn't have to do anymore. You don't have to shop. Everything's right there in your computer. So it's the horseless carriage, the horseless buggy situation, where people are playing with images of themselves, what they think are their chemical bodies, in a landscape and morphing it quadriphenically almost. But it is a new form of theme park. It's a hologram for people to remember what it was like to have a chemical body and to act it out.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual charm is always, you know, since TV is the tactile phatic interplay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
There's also this interesting crossover. There's a woman who is building a... She purchased an island in Second Life, which was just basically, you know, like 65,000 square miles of space on the grid, which she started developing. And she turned into a land developer and started landscaping the area and building structures with the help of a real life architect and bringing in various artists and people to design, park areas and things like that. And then she started selling, you know, property to people. People spend Linden dollars because it's the whole thing is created by these people called the Linden Lab, which are like these brothers, the Linden brothers or something like that. So people spend Linden dollars, and you can earn Linden dollars by performing various tasks or making various items, you know, using software that you can use to design objects that will function or serve a purpose in Second Life. You can sell them to people using your Linden dollars, but you know, she's got these high rent condos on this island that she developed, and so, you know, people that don't know how to earn money within the Linden economy will, you know, get in touch with this woman and like mail her, like, you know, say, well, look, here's $500 US currency, you know, please transfer, you know, XYZ condo plus the, you know, the surrounding property, you know, over to my avatar. She's become a millionaire in real life doing that.
Well, why do people pay real money
because when you first get in there, you're kind of stupid. You don't know your way around. You don't know what your options are. You don't know how to start making. You don't know how to earn money within the Linden economy. And the best people who do know how to earn money are actually people who happen to be talented at some skill in real life, such as architect, artist, musician, fashion designer. They start fashioning objects that can be traded with Linden dollars. Now if some of these items start becoming expensive because they're really finely crafted. So some newbie gets in there, he doesn't know how to make Linden dollars, he's not very artistic or creative, doesn't know how to make anything to barter with. And he just gets in touch with someone who's got, you know, a store that they've put a bunch of stuff for sale in, and he goes, look, I'll just give you some real money if you'll just transfer that over to my my avatar. And so that's how it happens.
So they haven't got anything to offer, so they send real money, so then Linden dollars of products are given to them.
Yeah. So, like, in the Linden world, you know, like this real estate developer, you know, one of her little cottages she has on her island, maybe it goes for 100,000 Linden dollars, but, you know, guy's only been in Second Life for, you know, a couple months. He doesn't know how to raise $100,000 of Linden money. So he gets in touch with her in real life through email or what have you and says, look, I'll give you, you know, $300 U.S. currency if you'll give me, you know, $100,000 apartment, you know. And she says, okay, I'll do that for you. And then what she can do is attach that item to his avatar. It becomes his property.
What does he do with the property? Then he can sell it?
Or he starts establishing a residence for himself, and he starts buying furniture, and he starts learning how to upgrade. You know, you can put the craziest thing, man. I hear that they have like virtual computers that you can get for your, you know, you can get for your desk, your desk. If you have a desk in your apartment, you know, you can put a virtual computer on it. There are web designers. There's some kind of Linden HTML code that web designers are using to design web pages for virtual computers that sit on your virtual desk inside your virtual house in Second Life. And you can punch in a little URL and it'll bring up an advertisement for some store on some other island that, you know, and it'll tell you where you can buy a pair of boots, and then you can transport yourself over to that other island, go into that store, shop around, get some boots for yourself or whatever. There are several. Apparently, they have 2,500 servers that are supporting this virtual world right now, and they plan to double or triple that during 2008. And there are several million objects that are part of the bartering system inside of the Second World now. That, you know, and so
just, to me, it seems that people are really struggling against the fact everything's visually disappeared, and they just don't know where to be in that situation. So they rebuild images of places when they had a chemical body.
Somebody did like a little theme song. Like, I was listening to this podcast. They play this little theme song this guy wrote about, you know, his life in Second Life. And he goes on and sings the virtues of Second Life, how in real life he's kind of a nerd and he doesn't have much of a social life. But in Second Life, you know, he has an avatar that acts kind of like a double agent, and that parties at the discos, and is getting a reputation among certain people, developing friends within certain groups, and he's developing a social life that he can't have in real life. And actually, there are a lot of people in, like, handicapped people in wheelchairs or what have you, that actually can't get out of the house, that are starting to create little avatars that can, you know, fly around and strut their stuff and meet other people. It gives them the sense of actually having a body.
Right, and it gives them a sense that there's someone else out there.
Yeah.
So when everything's disappeared and everybody's in their voluntary ESP, user-generated content broadcasting mode, and nobody's there to listen, and you gather names on your MySpace place as fast as possible just to create a sense of a crowd that's your audience. In a world where there's no audience in these electronic digital media, then the idea of creating and having an audience becomes an obsession.
Yeah, but this is more poignant than developing a list of names on your Facebook
right.
account or whatever, because you actually do get to recognize certain other avatars, and certain kinds of attractions happen between people. People get married in there. There are people that, like, are married and have a family, and then they have this secret marriage to some other avatar in Second Life, and a secret life that they're carrying on with someone that they may or may not ever meet in real life. But in Second Life, there is a sense of, you know, people who have hung out a lot together in Second Life and then meet each other in real life often say, oh, yeah, I recognize you from Second Life. There's something of your essence came through in our communication in Second Life, and you're kind of like, you know, I thought you would be.
Right. So my chart is showing four different bodies, and here you have a fanatic devotion to the chemical body operations. I mean, just as the televangelist evoked a great nostalgia for the Christian pew and the Christian church and the small town community and those theme parks in the 80s, but they actually were theme parks for the chemical body. We're now well past the chip landscape, and the chip body's becoming old hat, so that now you have people using their chip body. This is the juicy piece of meat. The chip body has a chemical body scenario so that one can remember having a virtual life. This is nostalgia. So Second Life really is Second Life for the chip body, which doesn't have much of a life anymore since we're into a post-chip body situation. So this is fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's two levels of juicy piece of meat. There's the chemical body imagery and the chip body itself. And a person can't go out in the street now and establish contact with anybody or any community because it's too threatening in the age of terror, so that we have a sense of comfort by going back to the chip landscape.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is... So I think the younger kids, the 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds, the text messengers, whatever they're doing right now,
mm-hmm.
they may not need that chemical body landscape. Second Life may not be a real attractive thing for them. You know what I mean? It's more Generation X and the baby boomers.
So no, I don't think it's baby boomers. I think it's younger than that.
Right, yeah, Generation X.
I think it's probably the average age in there right now is probably 20s and 30s. I'm guessing. I have no idea what the truth is about that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the teenagers go for something like that.
Yeah. Well, I know that like if I just think of my nephew, for instance, he's not in like a Second Life world, but he's in the gaming world where he goes online and goes through these obstacle courses in participating with or against other people in cyberspace, and he's in there solid. I mean, you can't prime away from it. He's in there to a degree that I find alarming. I mean, literally, he withdraws from any social situation other than maybe something on TV, and just goes right into his. And he's got these little portable handheld things that he just walks around, and he's just in there all the time.
And how old is he?
He's 10, I think.
Okay, now I understand the online gaming is the main activity of these obsessives. So there's probably online gaming on Second Life, right? But Second Life may be too slow. You build a house, you do this and that. Whereas the people involved with the online games, there's a lot of tactile interplay rapidly.
Yeah.
Happening. That may be what the young kids are.
Right. And they get a lot of ego strokes from making certain accomplishments, when my nephew would break through into some new chamber and get some new, token artifact or some new goal, he would be like, oh yeah, man, wow, wait till, Bob hears about this.
Did you say Bob or Mom?
I said Bob, I'm just making up a name, it's just one of his buddies,
Right. So, you can see that what is considered unreal and fake, 30 years ago, is now very real to people.
Yeah.
And
just to sum up what I was just thinking, to kind of capsulize, I think my experience of Second Life, I haven't actually gotten in there, and I created an avatar, but I'm observing people who do and listening to what they have to say and getting a sense of what's going on in there. And it's kind of like instead of going to the movies and watching a bunch of actors on the screen go through some kind of scenarios that create a sense of excitement within your own mind, it's like people are going in there and creating their own movies, creating their own movie piece, their own movie character, then creating their own like little movies and getting involved and putting themselves in the character rather than just watching it on the screen. And I'll tell you another thing, man. This is the topper. On one of the podcasts I listened to, the conversation they got into, this small group of people, was when was the first time, happens to everybody, when do you remember was the first time you had a dream? You went to sleep, it was the end of the day, you went home, you got home from work, you were tired, you went to sleep. When was the first time you had a dream you were in Second Life? So these people are projecting Second Life into the astral plane.
Right, well, there's more proof of my thesis that the astral plane and the chip body are merging.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, looking at the chart, now you get to, we've done monad, triad, and dyad. The tetrad is full-fledged conscious use of multiple factors. You're working through the monad, the dyad, and the triad. So the tetrad is when you get into the Android meme and you're watching the Android meme do a monadic, dyadic, triadic. So you could say that Reagan represents the monadic phase of the Android meme. George Bush represented the dyadic phase of the Android meme, and President Clinton in the 90s represented the triadic because he was famous for doing triangulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Triad, triangulation. So that is Bush the tetradic phase of the Android meme? The tetradic phase would be the interacting with the Android meme, which is almost itself doing tetrad management.
Mm-hmm.
And at least it's doing the monadic, dyadic, and the tetradic.
Mm-hmm.
No, the triadic. The monadic, dyadic, and triadic. So those, Reagan, first President Bush, former CIA director, and then Clinton, those phases are represented in the chart because the chart says the decade dance. But it represents now, or at least the now of the last 10 years. And that now is someone orchestrating all four, monad, dyad, triad, and tetrad, plus watching the Android meme do all four. So we call that the pentadic phase.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So remember, the pentadic aspects of the chart, which are from, the chart is 1960 to 1990, and it's the avant-garde effects preceding the causes. So by the time we get to the pentadic, which George Bush probably represents, the present George Bush, then it's an actualization of what was being developed from 60 to 90. Do you know what I mean? It's become a blatant figure, a cause, because it's, you could...
I have a hard time relating the present George Bush to Prospero, though. I don't know about Henry V.
Well, what's the network that supports them? Supposedly, it's Fox TV. Don't they apparently? Now, we go by what journalists and other media, older media, say about the Bush image. They say that Fox TV does not present news, it presents fantasy. All right? That's your Prospero. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And the fantasy medium supports the fantasy president. But the fantasy president does not seem to communicate, because it's very hard for the image of the chemical body to manifest the monadic, the triadic, the tetradic, the dyadic, and the pentadic. So we could say it is the pentadic, so I won't say that. I'll say the monadic, the triadic, the dyadic, and the tetradic. So that in the end people say, this guy is the worst president in history, the stupidest president. There's a breakdown of the public's ability to conceive or to absorb the meaning of a pentadic manager. Right.
Well, one thing I want to insert here, I don't know if it's true or not, I'd like to know what you think, but I was talking to someone about Bush the other day, his image in the public, and this person said to me that they believed that Bush was very intelligent, very well read, capable of being extremely articulate, and yet he puts on that he's kind of almost illiterate dummy in his presentation in the media. So it's a fake put on.
That's what I've heard. I heard someone saying that myself today somewhere. I overheard that. Seems, I don't know how long that's been around. I mean, I didn't say that particularly, but I said that the image of stupidity was more intelligent than people thought. So, but you're now starting to think that there's a person, people are saying there's a person there who's acting and pretending different aspects of himself.
Yeah, and why is he, and he's playing to an audience, so he must think that he's playing to a bunch of idiots, or like you would say, that there is no audience.
Right, and I think that that's what Bush communicates. I think people think there's too much effort. They're putting too much effort in Bush, what Bush has to do. He's just reality TV. He just acts himself. and knows that aspects that people want to project in there will communicate to them, even though he didn't intend that. But the basic charisma is he's not communicating. Now, if you tell people that the Android meme is doing tetrad management, and that's what you're inside of and receiving, it's very hard, without any long-range training of perception, to know what the heck I'm meaning and how would you receive the communications from the Android meme. Most people just say, well, it's chaotic, it's violent out there, and nobody seems to know what they're doing, and they're all idiots. That is as far as they can perceive it without any training in perception. But the fact that they can't imagine how it communicated, how it would be communicated to them, is actually what Bush is doing. He's not communicating to them. So that fascinates, because that's actually the closest that a chemical brain could perceive the complexity that my chart is showing.
Mm-hmm.
So that when Bush has a 60-minute interview or a press conference every now and then, he enters older media, there's all kinds of hallucinations about what the heck he's doing there, but he's flowing through it again effortlessly, and maybe even changes his presentation of himself. That's maybe where he might consciously do an act when he goes into older media, but he doesn't have to act when he's in the pentatic role, which is what we see as a guy who can't finish a sentence and is actually ill-informed and doesn't know anything that's going on. Mm. Reagan was an early version of that, right?
Right.
The image of him. So we have to look at the...
But that's going to change in the next election, because we're going to get... That's going to change in the next election, because we're going to get either Obama or Hillary, probably, and they're not going to put on that image.
No, well, this is... The complexity right now is that right now it looks like McCain's going to be president. That's the word today. Okay, that's just today,
right.
March 10th. McCain has, Cokie Roberts, I heard someone quoting this, Cokie Roberts said yesterday on the Sunday talk shows that it's absolutely unbelievable that McCain has come up and now equal in polls about presidential preference, considering he was supposedly a Republican, you know, part of that party that was... doing bad in the polls a year ago and unelectable. How come he's back in the race? Now they say it's partly because Obama and Hillary are blowing it with how they present themselves. So there's that right today. So I don't know if you can say Hillary or Obama's going to get in. Now, a lot of things, you know, it's almost like the president is McCain. Who's ever high in the polls is the president for that week or so. Then
yeah.
It changes.
Yeah.
When they become actually, when the actual president is elected, it goes and sits in a little chemical body box. That's when they've been retired, and they'll just show up occasionally for a press conference. They're not in the action, because all the media will be discussing the repercussions of the election for the first year or two, and then they'll start talking about the next president. And the discussion of whatever they're talking about is the president. That's the word that makes the market. It's just that the discussion this year is the election. So the election is the president right now. It's what is talked about that is the president, or the centralizing focus of the Android meme. You follow that?
Yeah.
Like Iraq, the Iraq's violence 2 or 3 years ago was the president. Okay?
Yeah. Well, it still is. That and the economy.
Oh, wait. What's... the Iraq... Well, I don't know. I don't watch the news. So is there much, I don't know what they're saying about Iraq right now. I don't hear much.
Well, the economy's beginning to overshadow.
Yes, the Wall Street's crash is the president right now, right? Over the past, maybe come the president this year, and they might have to cancel the election, the old election. They might not be able to stop and deposit someone in the White House. They might not be able to marginalize the president now, because the environment... economically expressed is the president right now, and it has no content.
Right.
So where are we at on the minute scale?
We're about time to take a break.
Okay, well, let's try to get back to the charts, though we are talking about the charts. When you talk about Second Life, that is indirectly what I'm trying to get at, but it's a subset of the chart, the Second Life thing, Second Life world you're talking about.
Right.
Okay, so we'll take a break.
Okay, see you in a few.
Yeah.